just some other comments on whether or not he was dead. The Roman executioners thought that he was dead, and that's what they did for a living. Usually when people are professionals at something, they're very, very good at what they do. Roman guards, who were executioners, executed people for a living until they were dead. You don't execute somebody until they're almost dead. You execute them until they're executed. And they said he was dead. If they didn't carry out their order to execute him, guess what the punishment was? Their death in his place. So guess what they always made sure of? That the dead were dead. The Jewish authorities thought he was dead. If the Jewish authorities didn't think he was dead, why ask Pilate for a guard to guard the tomb? The spectators who were around the cross thought he was dead. Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus begged for the body. They thought Jesus was dead. Unlike Elvis Presley, Jesus was dead. That's the only conclusion you can reach. Everybody else thought he was dead. You have to get about 1,800 years after the fact before somebody says, I don't think he was dead. The swoon theory. Governor of Louisiana believes that. Swoon theory states some pretty incredible things. It says that Jesus didn't die on the cross. He swooned. And when he was taken down, they put him in this cave. They roll a 2-ton stone in front of it. And then he gets up the next, he gets up 3 days later. Let me just go over the swoon theory. Jesus was sleepless for 2 days through 6 trials. He was beaten beyond recognition of a human being with a flagrum. He was so weak that he couldn't carry the cross beam for his cross. Spikes were driven through his feet and hands. A spear was thrust through his heart. He was pronounced dead by every eyewitness. His entire body was bound with 100 pounds of spices and sticky linen. And he was placed in a cold, damp tomb. And rather than getting pneumonia, what he does is neatly unwraps the linen bandages, folds them up carefully, and despite hands and feet punctured with gigantic nails, moves this 2-ton stone, fights and defeats 14 to 16 crack Roman infantrymen, walks on those bloody punctured feet, and says, I'm risen, victorious. Doesn't that make sense to you? Eli Camus said it best. He said, that would be more miraculous than the resurrection itself. Come on, boys and girls. It's so much easier to believe that he was who he said he was, God incarnate in the flesh, had the power of life, and came back to life. To show you some of the precautions that were taken when they did bury Jesus, he was wrapped with little strips of linen soaked in these sticky spices that were like super glue, real gummy type things. It says over 100 pounds of those spices, bandaged from head to foot. 2-ton stone was rolled in front of the grave. A Roman seal was placed on the tomb. If you break that Roman seal, the penalty is death. And the guard was probably a Roman guard. If it was, it consisted of 4 to 16 of the Green Beret Delta Force seals of their day. These were the best of the best. These were the guys that really you didn't want to mess with. And they slept in 4-man shifts. The 12 guys that would be sleeping, they stood guard in 4-man shifts, 12 sleeping. The 12 that would be sleeping would sleep with their feet out from the grave, their spears and their shields in front of their feet, so you would have to walk over spears, shields, and then 12 sleeping soldiers just to get to the 4 that you got to fight. That's pretty tough, y'all. Now, you're talking about having apostles do that, that were too afraid to even show up at the crucifixion. You think they're going to show up for the fight? If Jesus was dead, what makes you think that he resurrected? And the two key things here, empty tomb and his appearance. Paul makes this comment in Acts 26:26. The king knows of these things, for I am persuaded that none of these things were hidden from him, for this thing was not done in a corner. There were enough people who hated Jesus in Jerusalem that if that grave was not empty, they could have gone and checked it out. If Jesus had not risen, they would have found those 500 eyeball witnesses. There were enough people saying this that it could have been very, very easily disproved. And there were more than enough critics in Jerusalem at the time who were anxious, eager, and able to disprove it. Let me ask you this. Don't you think that Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of the next week, everybody on their lunch hour walked down to that tomb and stuck their head in? I mean, that's what I... Ain't there? He's gone. Everybody checked that out. That was the big news in Jerusalem. And it was too easy to check out. But was the tomb really empty? Kirsop Lake developed this theory that the women went to the wrong tomb. Well, the whole world went to the wrong tomb. How do women go to the wrong tomb? Everybody went to the wrong tomb. The Roman guard went to the wrong tomb. Joseph of Arimathea went to the wrong tomb. Peter and John went to the wrong tomb. And if they did go to the wrong tomb, let me just ask you this. Since the Jews wanted more desperately than anything else to keep that body in the grave, why didn't the Jews just go to the right tomb and pull out the body and say, hey, shut up, Peter, here he is. He's dead. That tomb was empty. Trust me, if those Levitical priests could have found that body, they'd have produced it. They had a lot of money at stake. Unknown tomb, as we said, everybody knew where the tomb was. Furthermore, it says in Luke 23:55, the women also which came with him from Galilee followed after and beheld the sepulcher. It was real easy to find that tomb. It was the only one that had a guard on it. And that must have been pretty unusual, huh? Most people don't guard the tomb. Who are you trying to keep out? Trying to keep men. Oh, yeah. Makes sense to me. Did they spread a legend about the resurrection? Most important thing about this is that legends can be very easily disproved at the time they take place because you have hostile eyewitnesses that would disprove them. Legends take long time to perpetuate. Legends don't survive under persecution. And legends don't begin with very timid, scared people. The whole legend theory is nonsense. What about the official story? Did the disciples come and steal the body? That's what the Jews told the Roman soldiers to say. There's many, many problems with that. Number one, Roman soldiers did not fall asleep on guard duty. And let's say this, only one group would do it in any given lifetime. Because when you fell asleep on guard duty as a Roman soldier, you were stripped naked, your clothes and your equipment were placed in a little pile, they were doused with kerosene, you were doused with kerosene, you were made to stand on them, and in front of the entire troop, you were lit on fire. Good example for other folks not to fall asleep. It was strong incentive. It's reported by, and I can't remember the Roman historian, but it's in Josh McDowell's book, that sleeping on guard duty was one of the few problems that the Roman army very rarely came across. Very rarely did that ever happen. Second thing, how do you know anything when you're asleep? Remember the Jews said, listen, if Pilate asked you about it, just tell him while we were asleep, they stole the body. How do you know you were asleep? If these guys went into court with that story, that would be embarrassing. You don't know anything when you're asleep. You know stuff when you wake up. True? There's no way you can give that testimony, so the official story doesn't hold true. Not only were the guards asleep, they must have been deaf. You got a 2-ton stone that's moved up an incline some distance away. How come they didn't hear that? And again, Luke and Mark go into the Greek word apokulio, which means separation some distance from the tomb. And what we find archaeologically in that area, when we look at the hard evidence, is that a lot of times these giant stones were rolled in front of the tomb, but in order to get the stone down in front of that tomb, it would start uphill and roll in a little gully, a little ditch that had been hollowed out. So you just took the peg out from the stone and it would roll by itself. So whoever got that body out the grave didn't only have to move the stone uphill, he had to pick it up out of its track and move it away. From the wording, that's what it appears. The other thing is that the clothes was really neat. It says that the headdress was folded neatly. Thieves who had just fought off 16 of Rome's finest, they didn't fight them, they tiptoed around to move this 2-ton stone, they wouldn't be so neat as to say, okay, let's unwrap the body. We just got 100 pounds of spices and linen to go. And fold up that thing. And you know that whoever would have done that, it would not have been a good Jew. Why? Good Jews don't touch dead things. Especially on the Sabbath, or right after. The other thing, a lot of people lost their life, were killed because of one belief and statement. That being that a dead man got up out the grave. You don't die for what you know to be a lie. And all of the apostles, with the exception of John, by tradition from the church fathers, died saying and believing that that dead man had gotten up out of the grave. And were willing to die. If you get a chance, read Fox's Book of Martyrs and see how they were tortured. If you can stomach it. Did the Jews steal a body? Nope. Why would they bribe the guard if they stole the body? They had the body. They wouldn't have to. Why did they even need a guard if that was their intent? They would not have wanted a guard. And the Jews had every reason not to steal a body. The Romans didn't steal a body. Pilate wanted peace at any cost. about this time, the man who had appointed Pilate in Rome had been convicted of treason. And everybody that he had appointed was under suspicion and investigation. The last thing Pilate needed was a big uprising in Jerusalem, because that would have probably cost him his head. A lot of people say, well, was it a spiritual resurrection? That's not a resurrection of the Jews. Jews were waiting for a bodily resurrection. It's not the Jesus of Luke 24:39. Jesus says, handle me, see, for a spirit has not flesh and bones as you see me have. And again, back to the Jehovah Witnesses who say that Jesus did not resurrect his body. How do you explain this, that he has flesh and bones? It's not the Jesus of John 2. And again, there would be no reason to bribe the Jewish guard. It's not a hallucination. Circumstantial evidence surrounding the resurrection. The church began in spite of persecution. Now, that's a funny thing. Islam, the religion of the Muslims, began at the point of a sword. They put a sword at your throat and said, would you like to convert? And most people said, well, yeah, that's a good idea. I was thinking about it yesterday. Really thinking about it now. At the point of a sword, people lost their head and said, I'm not giving up my belief. Sunday worship, what would make a good Jew disregard a direct commandment and begin worshiping on the first day of the week? It would have to be something real impressive, like a dead man getting up out the grave. Baptism is a public display of their profession of faith in spite of the severe persecution that it would entail. Communion, the changed lives of the apostles from cowards to bold witnesses for Christ. The calendar. Every time you put the date on the calendar, you recognize that a large number of people believed that a dead man got up out the grave. What about the people who have looked at the evidence? I showed you this the other night. Professor Thomas Arnold, 14-year headmaster of Rugby, author of the famous three-volume History of Rome, chair of modern history at Oxford, said, quote, I know of no one fact in the history of mankind which is proved by better and fuller evidence of every sort, and that's the kind of error that I make, to the understanding of a fair inquirer than the great sign which God has given us that Christ died and rose again from the dead, unquote. What this man is saying is that the resurrection is a fact proved by tremendous amount of evidence. He's not saying that it has anything whatsoever to do with a religious belief, a warm, fuzzy feeling, or anything else. It is a fact based upon evidence, and he knows of no other fact in history proved by better and fuller evidence. Yeah, but he's a prejudiced eyewitness. Okay. What about a hostile eyewitness? Remember we said that's the best kind to get? Here's two hostile eyewitnesses. Frank Lloyd Morrison was a gentleman who decided to write a book in which he disproved the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the book he wrote instead was called Ben-Hur. Became a Christian. I'm sorry, not Ben-Hur. He wrote a book called Who Moved the Stone, in which he presented the evidence overwhelmingly and talked about how he, through careful investigation of the evidence, came to the conclusion that the resurrection of Jesus Christ must be a fact of history. And he became a Christian. But the person that I always like to talk about is Simon Greenleaf, atheist Jew, was the man that was responsible for the reputation at Harvard Law School today. Greenleaf was challenged by some of his law students to disprove the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ based upon the available evidence, and Greenleaf was the world's foremost authority. He has written a two-volume series on what constitutes legal evidence in a court of law. If you were going to court, you would refer to Greenleaf's book to know whether or not your evidence was good enough to stand up in court. And the reason why you would want to use Greenleaf's book is because the judge would use Greenleaf's book. He's the authority. He's the final stop. And Greenleaf, after investigating for a period of time, came to the conclusion that the bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ was one of the best established facts in the history of the world before the age of printing. And he became a Christian. And he started Simon Greenleaf's School of Apologetics. Now here's a man who's an atheist who starts with a prejudice, and not in spite of the evidence, but because of the evidence, and in spite of his prejudice, he becomes a believer. We can talk science all day long. I can show you how dinosaurs fit with the Bible. I can show you geological evidence for a worldwide flood, which was what I was going to do tonight. I think I can even prove the young age of the earth. But it still comes down to one fact, which has nothing to do with religion. It has only to do with history, and that historical fact will never change. Did Jesus Christ get up out of the grave? And the offer and the implication is very clear. He says, I have power over death. I can beat death. Doc, you don't save lives. You delay death. I genuinely save lives. And I'm going to put up a shut up. I'm going to prove I have power over death. And I'm going to make it not science, which changes, but I'm going to make it history, which doesn't. And support it with so much overwhelming evidence that if you deny it, you're without excuse. He says, if you believe on that one event in point time history, accept his death as payment for your imperfections, he'll give you the gift of eternal life. Absolutely free. What an incredible offer. He says, if you reject it and you never come to grips with the fact that his death was the only way to get right with the infinite personal creator God, then God, in order not to be a liar, will send you to an eternity separated from him, which will be incredibly painful. I firmly feel hell exists for the same reason. You have eyewitness reports. Dr. Maurice Rawlings, the man who developed the CPR manual, wrote the first CPR manual. He collected over 200 eyewitness reports of patients who died and went to hell. 5 Buddhist and Hindu patients died and experienced hell. And Buddhist and Hindus have no knowledge of hell. They had had no previous knowledge of hell. Because a lot of people say, oh, well, all those people that died and experienced hell, that was just what they had been taught all their life. What do you do with Buddhist and Hindus who have no knowledge of hell and experience it? Could be real. If Jesus was right about the resurrection, and he was, he's probably right about hell. And he's the same God that wrote those 332 prophecies and fulfilled them. If he's right that often, he's right about this one too. And this is the final place that we should take everybody. Close with this quote by Wilbur Smith. Resurrection of Christ is the very citadel of the Christian faith. This is the doctrine that turned the world upside down in the first century, that lifted Christianity preeminently above Judaism and the pagan religions of the Mediterranean world. If this goes, so must almost everything else that is vital and unique in the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. If Christ be not risen, then is your faith in vain. Just like this doctrine turned the world upside down in the first century, I still believe this is the doctrine that could turn the world upside down in the 20th century. And that's why Chet and I did this weekend. So that you could get this knowledge, so that you could go out and be prepared always to give an answer to every man. Sometimes that answer isn't just telling him how old the earth is. Always the answer comes back to the resurrection of Jesus Christ and the offer of eternal life. I'm going to hang around if y'all have any questions. Any questions? How they derive the probability numbers. Yeah. I'll give you the reference. John Ankerberg's book talks about it a little bit more. Burrell does, his book, let me give you his reference, if I can find it. And he walks you through all of how he determines his probability. He takes an improbable event, multiplies it times the number of atoms in the universe that could possibly be packed in, times the reaction rate, which he expands drastically, and says this is the most number of interactions you could have among atoms, and a negligible probability is 1 chance in 1,000,000, and then he divides that out and he says, yeah, from his book, Elements of the Theory of Probability, and his other book, Probability of Life, in both those cases he gets tremendous probabilities. Now, in the probability of life, he gets even higher numbers than this. He gets... He comes, in that book, he says 10 to the minus 50th power is the absolute limit of what a human observer would see on Earth, which would apply to the resurrection of a man on earth. The probabilities for Jesus, you would take all the towns in Israel, because you know it's going to be a Jewish Messiah. Take their populations. What are the odds that it would be one man coming from any of those towns? Narrow it even further down, because he has to come from the tribe of Judah, and so forth and so on. What are the odds that he would be crucified? This is not a Jewish form of burial, so there would be no chance. Well, that's an infinite probability. He had to make adjustments for that. Yes, sir.
I heard that there was some problems with the prince in the Biloxi River and the people they filmed. They kind of had to retract.
Yeah. Surely do. There were problems with the footprints in the Biloxi River, because what happened is that the human footprint began to change shape in the mid-80s. And when that human footprint in the mid-80s began to change shape, it looked like a human footprint. Okay? And what happened is that as it became submerged underwater, it started to take on an appearance like that. And that looks like a dinosaur footprint. And everybody looked at it and said, whoa, that looks like a dinosaur footprint. And it does. I mean, there's no question about it. So what they did is they pulled it off the video that had been made with John Morris. They pulled that off the market. And he said, we really don't know what's going on. It wasn't painted on, because core samples showed that it wasn't painted. And I'm looking for that picture. But they really didn't know. So just to be honest, they said, let's pull it off the market so that there's no problem with it, and so that nobody thinks we're trying to pull a hoax. Which I think is to the credit of the creation scientists, because they did the right thing. But, okay, I don't think I have it. What they did, though, is that they came back, and Carl Ball and Don Patton kept looking at that and looking at that and working with it. And when we had that severe drought in 88, 89, they dammed the river, and they went back to the footprint. And they were able to make contour diagrams of the footprint. They were able to take out some of the overlying sandstone, limestone, and they were able to show that what had happened on the contour diagrams, you can see it, is that there was a human footprint inside of a dinosaur footprint. To confirm that, because what the evolutionists were saying, you see, we told you they were all fake. They were all carved in the limestone. Somebody snuck in there and carved a footprint where there was a dinosaur footprint. So what they did is they took a footprint and they cut through the heel to look for pressure lines. Because if you find pressure lines, you know that it wasn't carved. There has to be at least 150 pounds of force to make a pressure line in the limestone. And they were there. Well, the evolutionist said, ah, that's because his heel was in the dinosaur heel. We said, fine, what if we section through the ball of the foot and the toes? If they're in the toes, they weren't caused by the dinosaur. If they were in the ball of foot, they probably weren't caused by the dinosaur because of the shape of their foot. And sure enough, there were pressure lines in all places. So Carl Baugh and Don Patton have gone out now and presented this evidence to everyone who'll listen. And I think it's definitive. There's no question about it. ICR is thinking about promoting this again. But they're being very, very cautious, because they felt like they got burned the last time. And that's why I keep coming back. Science changes. The same two-edged sword that cuts the evolutionist cuts my science also. My science and creation science is plagued by lack of evidence, by incomplete evidence, by withheld evidence. I hope not by faked evidence, and that's what we're trying to do. But science is always changing. Everyone's science is changing. Creation science will change. That's great, because it means we're learning more and we're getting more data. The thing that's not going to change is what? History. And that's why God chose to reveal himself, not in science, but how? Historically. It's sure. And that's what he said. You want a test for me? We'll make it an historical test. We'll make it a really tough test. Predict the future. Whenever the evolutionist puts time on things, he's always putting his evolutionary theory up front. The thing that we can date, the oldest thing we can date, is about 2300 BC, and it's an Egyptian artifact. Now, he'll say that we find cultures that go all the way back to 10,000 BC. There's no way to date those cultures. There's no carbon-14 test or anything else that dates that pottery. What he says is, if my theory of how civilizations and cultures evolve is correct, then this is the date it should be. So the oldest indication that we have for man from if you want to call it an objective test, a carbon 14 test, would be about 2300 BC. And again, that date is probably too old, because we realize now that all of our carbon 14 dates need to be adjusted for the non-equilibrium state of carbon 14 in the atmosphere. And the guy who developed carbon 14 dating knew that, and he just ignored it. Well, 2300 BC. Well, he wants to say that man came about 10,000 years ago. And that's fine. The thing he's having trouble is trying to find out where man came from. For a long time, it was Neanderthal man. Well, now he admits that Neanderthal man is modern man. In fact, C. Loring Brace at the University of Michigan says that Neanderthal man is identical to modern Western Europeans. What do you do with an expert like that? This man's examined 2,000 skeletons. Yes, sir.
You were going to describe, I think, the idea of light traveling at 186,000 miles an hour, and the idea of two points being stretched, and you were explaining how that works. Is that still within your thing? Could you still do that?
Let me talk to you later about that, because that is such a difficult concept. Even the people that write about it say it's not an intuitive concept. It's not something that you're going to really be able to get a good intuitive picture for. The mathematics is easier to understand. The key is that if space is stretching, the coordinates are stretching with it. And that space can stretch faster than the speed of light. It's not confined by that. The light itself, because it's within the universe, would be confined to its own speed. And that's if relativity is correct. A gentleman shared with me an article that's now questioning relativity, as several people have. But again, the mathematics gets very, very complex, and it's not an intuitive concept. General relativity is not something that we can, because we've never seen anything like it. The balloon analogy is close, but it's still not exactly what's going on out there mathematically. And remember, that's all mathematical theory. Nobody has been able to test it, and probably never will. I'd refer you to this too. In 1994, Dr. Russ Humphreys is going to speak at the International Symposium on Creation Science in Pennsylvania, I want to say, someplace in Pennsylvania. And he's got a mathematical model worked out for that light issue. But I think it's basically the same thing that Sky and Telescope is speaking about.
So when somebody talks about a star being so many billion light years away, I mean, are they basing this on their calculations?
It's not measured, yes. When you say that this star is billions of light years away, it's based upon a lot of assumptions, and it's nothing that anybody's gone out there and measured billions of light years. You can only measure something, I want to say 300 light years away is the maximum you can measure by direct measurement, by parallax. But all of the other measurements are based upon the luminosity of the star, if the evolutionary history of the star is correct, if the Hirschsprung-Russell diagram is correct, which is based upon the evolution of the star, and if Hubble's constant holds true. And in order to work out Hubble's constant, you've got to know the distance to the star. So you've got to know the distance to get the distance. It's a classic case of circular reasoning. It really is. So, yes, sir.
By mathematics alone, you can prove that the so-called primordial stuff, under certain laboratory conditions or even certain primitive conditions that existed in an evolutionary state, it is impossible for life of any form to have come into existence.
H.J. Morowitz, who's considered one of the world's most renowned physical chemists, said that the mathematical odds that one E. coli bacteria would evolve any place in the universe in 5 billion years is 1 chance in 10 to the 100 billionth power. That's a 1 with 100 billion zeros behind it. Now, Fred Hoyle is an optimist. He says, no, it's only 1 chance in 10 to the 40,000th power. Those numbers are absurd. Morowitz, in spite of what he writes, is still an evolutionist. You talk about faith. I don't have that much faith as a Christian. Paul didn't. He said, look, eyeball witnesses, go ask them. That's faith, y'all. You got to respect that kind of faith. You got to run from that kind of faith. Let me be honest. Paul, when he worked out those calculations, finally concluded there must be a God.